the Malcolm's organization. He, you know, he did that as and joined the security force, and he ended up being on Malcolm's security, and he was on the security when Malcolm was assassinated in the Audubon.
And your father interviewed him extensively. In the last 30 seconds we have, and then we're going to do part two, Tammy, if you can talk about what most surprised you and the work you did with this with your father on Malcolm X's life.
Working on this book for 30 years, I mean, there are a lot of things that came out that, you know, that were interesting. And I think for me, it was more that, you know, where this path was in, of the work was taking us. And not so much it was surprising, but just learning and understanding about that time. I mean, this is a time before I was born. And so this is history that's hugely impactful to us.
Tomorrow we're going to have to leave it there, but we're not leaving it there because we're going to do a post-show interview with you and post online at democracynow.org. Tamara Payne is the daughter of the late journalist Les Payne. They co-authored the book The Dead Are Arising, The Life of Malcolm X. It just won the National Book Award. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez.
Portland.
I'm Selena Flores.
And I'm Mike Crenshaw. We're your hosts for this episode of It Did Happen Here. Episode 3 is the story of the Coalition for Human Dignity, or CHD.
The CHD did have a lot of contact with a lot of different groups. I was a staff person of the CHD. I was also a member of ACT UP in Portland. I had a very strong relationship with leadership at the Lesbian Community Project and in a variety of other places in the city. My connections became the organization's connections, and the organizational leadership at the board level also brought many relationships to the organization.
Check out the It Did Happen Here podcast at itdidhappenherepodcast.com. You can also go to kboo.fm and search It Did Happen Here.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closures of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News, Governor Brown unveils her proposed budget and policy agenda for the next 2 years. A federal judge says the Portland police used excessive force in violation of a court order during protests on June 30th. And the Trump administration is under investigation for allegedly accepting political services in exchange for a presidential pardon. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, December 2nd, 2020. I'm Althea Billings. The Oregon Health Authority reported 1,244 new cases of COVID-19 on Wednesday, bringing the total number of confirmed and presumptive cases in the state up to 78,160. Oregon health officials also reported 18 new deaths, bringing the death toll in the state up to 953 people. At least 1,000 new cases have been reported in Oregon in 12 of the last 13 days. Governor Kate Brown rolled out a new risk assessment system guided by COVID-19 spread across the state. 25 counties are now in the extreme risk category, meaning social gatherings are still limited to 6 people or less, and takeout from restaurants is highly recommended, though some restaurants will be offering outdoor seating. Multnomah County Chair Deborah Cafori says many counties, especially those with higher populations like Multnomah, will likely stay in the extreme risk category for some time. Governor Brown said of the new risk assessment system, quote, "Until COVID-19 vaccines are widely available, health and safety precautions will remain in place. At every risk level to prevent COVID-19 outbreaks, Oregonians must continue to wear facial coverings, watch their physical distance, wash their hands, stay home when sick, and keep social gatherings small." Governor Kate Brown unveiled her proposed 2021 to 2023 budget on Tuesday. The proposal calls for racial justice, disaster relief for pandemic, and for wildfires. It also relies on the hope that Congress will come through to help the state combat some of its issues. Since the pandemic started, 150,000 people have joined the Oregon Health Plan, which is the state's version of Medicaid. Governor Brown said that increased enrollment has created a massive monetary gap that will require, quote, "asking our already stressed health system to share in the sacrifice." Becky Holtberg is the president and CEO of the Oregon Association of Hospitals and Health Systems. She indicated that the cut comes at poor timing, saying, quote, "Governor Brown has chosen to propose direct cuts to hospitals in the middle of the biggest public health crisis in a century. Cuts of this magnitude could force hospitals to reduce service to Oregonians during a pandemic," end quote. Brown also proposed allocating $10 million for a pilot program that would expand health care for undocumented children. And while the Oregon Employment Department's computer system has delayed many Oregonians' jobless benefits during the pandemic, it will be replaced by 2025, according to the governor. Tens of thousands of Oregonians are still waiting to learn whether they're eligible to receive benefits. Governor Brown is also requesting $146 million for the Employment Department to replace the system and to launch a new family leave program. The state's new paid family and medical leave program will begin paying benefits in 2023 to new parents, victims of domestic violence, and those caring for sick family members. The governor's budget does not include an increase in taxes on beer and wine, which recovery advocates were pushing for. The Oregon Health Authority also proposed an alcohol tax hike in its budget request. Other proposal elements include $73 million for fire preparedness, $360 million to clean and rebuild communities impacted by the wildfires this year, and $118 million to expand broadband access in urban and rural communities. Brown also pledged to introduce bail reform next year and to close 3 prisons in the state over the next 2 years. There are only 3 state workplaces with more COVID-19 cases than Amazon's Troutdale warehouse, and those are all state prisons. That's according to the Oregon Health Authority's November 25th outbreak disclosure. There are 97 known cases of COVID-19 at the Troutdale warehouse, but little else is known about the outbreak. That's because all entry-level employees at Amazon's warehouse are required to sign a non-disclosure agreement, or NDA. NDAs are rarely required of warehouse workers. Amazon's NDA prohibits employees from acquiring, using, disclosing, or communicating, quote, "any confidential information, except as required in connection with employees' work, without the prior written approval of an authorized officer of Amazon." Amazon spokeswoman Ann Laughlin Carpita told Willamette Week, quote, "Non-disclosure agreements are signed by Amazon employees when they are hired to help ensure customer privacy and for other business purposes." The Troutdale warehouse has often been near the top of Oregon's list of COVID-19 workplace outbreaks since the Oregon Health Authority started publicizing those numbers in May. Amazon workers in Germany recently went on strike during the Black Friday weekend, demanding better working conditions in the face of the pandemic. On Monday, a federal judge ruled Portland police officers violated the court order restraining them from using munitions against nonviolent protesters. U.S. District Judge Marco Fernandez found the city in contempt of court for violating the order 3 times on the night of June 30th. The temporary restraining order was put in place after the nonprofit Don't Shoot PDX filed a lawsuit against the city for the police use of excessive violence against nonviolent protesters. The order is meant to prohibit police from using munitions unless faced with a threat or assault. The judge looked at 9 incidents of police violence that occurred that night outside the Portland Police Association building as a representative sample of police conduct during the summer's protests. 3 of these 9 incidents were found to be indefensible. Officer Brent Taylor was involved in 2 of them. First, when he shot a protester carrying a banner in the legs 5 times with so-called less lethal rounds. Taylor claimed he thought the protesters would weaponize the banner. He also shot 10 rounds at people trying to help a fallen roller skater to their feet. Taylor said he thought the roller skater was under arrest at the time. The officer who shot at someone stooping down and presenting no threat was not able to be identified in the video presented. Lawyers for the Don't Shoot PDX class action lawsuit say this week's decision is promising for the court case to come, especially because the judge only looked at police actions from one night before coming to his decision. Juan Chavez is a lawyer representing the accountability group. Chavez told the Mercury on Monday, quote, "We've had many more nights since then. When we try this case before a jury, we're going to find these violations on nearly any night we examine." Portland police have reported using force well over a staggering 6,000 times since racial justice protests sparked by the murder of George Floyd began in May. This number is believed to be a low estimate because it relies on officers self-reporting and often counts multiple blows from a club and multiple munition rounds as just one incident when officers are unable to be giving a specific number. At this time, it's unclear what, if any, sanctions the city will face for violating the order. But the judge's ruling may make it more difficult for Portland to achieve compliance with an earlier Department of Justice settlement. In 2014, the federal government found Portland police to be using a pattern of excessive force, especially against people experiencing mental illness. Since then, the city has been required to report and review use of force following specific DOJ guidelines. A decision over the city's compliance is expected this January. A ruling of non-compliance could have negative impacts on future attempts at reform and oversight, as details of the settlement make it difficult for the city to make changes while it's under review. The coronavirus pandemic has posed serious challenges for the bar and restaurant industry in Oregon. KBOO's Jeffrey Wade spoke with Oregon Liquor Control Commission spokesperson Bryant Haley about how the OLCC are enforcing coronavirus restrictions in restaurants and bars across the state, the question of to-go cocktails, and advice on what small businesses can do to stay afloat.
As Governor Kate Brown announced she would be lessening her November freeze orders, allowing outside table service at bars and restaurants beginning December 3rd, many bar and restaurant owners are still scratching their heads on how to stay afloat. A bone of contention with many bar owners is the inability to sell cocktails to go. Currently, 33 states allow the sale of hard liquor beverages to go, including Washington State, which passed temporary legislation in May allowing cocktails to go as long as they were part of a full meal and in a sealed container. I spoke with Bryant Haley, the alcohol spokesperson for the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, about these current conditions and how the OLCC deals with establishments in this time of COVID-19. Hi, Bryant. Thanks for speaking with me today. Overall, are bars in Oregon adhering to the ongoing coronavirus restrictions?
You know, Jeff, that's a great question. What's been going on with COVID has put definitely a strain on bars industry. I mean, that's on the table. We know that. But as well as upon our inspectors, who are people as well. You know, they have lives, families to go home to on the weekends. And they've been out there working with licensees. I think it's important for your listeners to understand that our inspectors build a rapport with licensees. Educate is what we push from the top down, from our commissioners to executive director to our directors of compliance who oversee the inspectors and our licensing crew. We want the industry to work, and we're very aware. We've heard loud and clear from the industry of the stresses that COVID has placed upon the overall industry. So we have to be in the middle on that. We work with our health partners to balance those public health issues that are coming down the pipe at us constantly, as well as with industry. How can we make this industry continue to work? We've been an agency on pivot the entire time with all of these issues. When we receive a complaint or an inspector notices something out of whack with any laws and rules or any of the COVID precautions and social distancing, our inspectors go in, they provide education, they sit down with the licensee, go over, provide the information that OHA has given us for guidance, for the sector guidance for bars and restaurants, and goes over it. If we still have a problem, you know, that's a verbal warning. Next, it goes to OSHA. And from there, you know, if people continue not to get in line, then there's other issues we have to take. That's not something that anyone at the agency enjoys whatsoever. It's about getting a safe environment to, you know, continue to have Oregon be a leading, you know, bar and restaurant industry that attracts people to come to Oregon. So some bars and restaurants are getting it. They're taking it. They have the bleach bucket out, wiping down tables and high contact points. And there's been some places, you know, unfortunately, we've had to go to other measures because they haven't taken our warnings and haven't heeded our guidance.
33 states allow cocktails to go, including Washington. Why has that option not been considered in Oregon?
The problem is in Oregon, when you have a full on-premises bar, that's what a bar that serves cocktails, drinks, shots, spirits by the glass, it's called a full on-premises license. That license refers to, throughout the statute, consumption must occur on-premises. So we don't have legal way as an administrative agency to allow for that conduct to occur. I mean, administrative agencies like the OLCC are beasts of statute, meaning that we're told what to do by the law. Legislators pass bills, pass laws that we then implement. And we just simply don't have that privilege to give out to allow enable cocktails to go, because the health community has asked us questions about some of the, you know, some of the things that we've done during COVID as an agency. You know, delivery's been on the books since 1933 when we legalized alcohol consumption in Oregon. But if we do get a bill, if we do get a direction to go ahead and do this, how would we do it? What would it look like? You know, we have run a lot of trap lines on this issue.
Thank you, Bryant, very much for your time today. In closing, do you have any additional advice you can give to struggling bar and restaurant owners?
I would continue to say, be aware of the opportunities out there. You know, we worked with the National Beverage Association for Control States, NABCA. We've worked with Family Meal to get them grant money to waterfall down to service permit workers, bars and restaurant workers, as well as look at what the grants are coming out through counties and cities and the state. I know that money evaporated a little quicker than other people, than, you know, everyone wanted a little bit of it, and that's just representative of the challenges current in the industry. But contact your legislature, reach out, ask what's going on. And, you know, if cocktails to go is something that, you know, your listeners are looking into, look up that website, look up your legislature, and have a conversation with them or one of their staff about this issue.
For the KBOO Evening News, I'm Jeffrey Wade.
The U.S. Justice Department is investigating an alleged bribery for pardon scheme at the White House, according to an August court filing unsealed yesterday. The heavily redacted document alleges that an individual offered, quote, a substantial political contribution in exchange for a presidential pardon or reprieve of sentence. The document also alleges that two individuals whose names are blacked out acted improperly as lobbyists, offering money to secure the pardon. The Justice Department investigators seized more than 50 digital devices, including iPhones, laptops, thumb drives, and computer drives from unidentified offices. Last week, President Trump pardoned Michael Flynn, his former national security advisor, and allegedly discussed with Rudy Giuliani, his personal lawyer, a, quote, preemptive pardon for Giuliani. You are listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report debunking stories around COVID-19 hosted by an infectious diseases specialist and a community health expert. At 5:45, it's news from the Boo, your look at the news inside KBOO. Then at 7, tune in for Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be clear with a low of 35. Tomorrow's weather will be mostly cloudy with a high of 48 degrees. Today in history, in 1859, abolitionist John Brown was executed by the United States government. Brown was deeply involved in the Underground Railroad, helping over 2,500 slaves escape over a 10-year period. He believed his singular purpose to be ending slavery and lived by the golden rule that we should treat others how we want to be treated. The quote of the day is from Harriet Tubman, who met Brown in 1859 and helped plan the raid on Harper's Ferry that Brown would eventually pay for with his life. Tubman said, quote, "Every great dream begins with a dreamer. Always remember you have within you the strength, the patience, and the passion to reach for the stars to change the world." A recount is underway in Gresham as the two candidates for mayor are neck and neck, separated by only 13 votes. KBOO's Brian Oster has more on the story.
Multnomah County is recounting ballots for Gresham's mayoral race. The two candidates who are nearly tied are Eddie Morales and Travis Stovall. Multnomah County Elections Director Tim Scott says a race this close calls for an automatic recount.
Currently, the race is 13 votes apart. Travis Stovall is leading by 13 votes. And Oregon law requires that whenever an election contest is within 0.2%, we must, it's called an automatic recount.
Ballot counters spent all of Monday and half of Tuesday unsealing 1,200 boxes of ballots from the November 4th election and extracted the 52,000 ballots that came from Gresham. This afternoon, they began hand-counting those Gresham ballots to tally the race for mayor. Ballot counters work in tables of four called boards. Each board receives a box of ballots, sorts them, and checks their counts against each other. Boards are bipartisan, so ballot counters on each board must come from different political parties. If a ballot is questionable, like a vote is scratched out and corrected, board members discuss how to interpret the voter's intent. Their adjudication decision is final and will replace November 4th's digital adjudication in the official tally. Travis Stovall stopped in to observe the recount process today, as did newly elected Secretary of State Shamia Fagan, who's now in charge of elections. Stovall says he was impressed by the process.
Just the thoroughness of the way the software system works and then the actual double-checking of just about every part of the process that goes on is very impressive.
Elections Director Tim Scott says while it's possible that the outcome will change, it isn't likely.
I've never seen a recount change the outcome of an election. Now, in my 20-year career, there have been recounts that have changed the outcome of an election, but not in any jurisdiction that I was working in at the time.
Whatever the outcome, Stovall says he's grateful to everyone involved.
This is a massive process and an incredible undertaking, and just would just be thankful for everybody and the citizens for the patience as we go through this entire process to make sure every vote counts.
Final hand counts should be completed by the end of this week to determine who is the next mayor of Gresham, Eddie Morales or Travis Stovall. For KBOO Evening News, I'm Brian Oster.
Hillsborough City Council is taking steps to adopt a new system for police accountability. In a work session Tuesday night, council members reviewed current oversight measures and heard from the city's policing work group about possible new forms of oversight. The policing work group was formed earlier this summer, following increased public demands for reform that came in the wake of protests against the murder of George Floyd by police in Minneapolis. In last night's work session, they presented four different civilian oversight models, along with recommendations for improvements to both oversight as well as police and community relationships. The potential oversight models differed in level of police involvement in internal investigations. The first would create an independent civilian board to investigate cases of officer misconduct and report directly to the chief of police. This model is similar to the one Portlanders overwhelmingly voted to replace in this year's election. The workgroup admits it doesn't address community involvement in policies and procedures. The second model makes police officers the investigators who present findings to a board of community members who would then make recommendations to the police chief. A third option involves an outside auditor or agency instead of police or community members. This auditor would provide clearer objectivity and a more systemic perspective, but it would take the community out of the equation. The final option presented creates an expert panel to review policy and procedure and to make recommendations for changes. It is unclear at this time whether the city will go forward with any of these options or even a hybrid of more than one. Portland's new oversight board will be made up of a diverse group of community members with no personal or professional ties to the Portland Police Bureau. It will have the power to subpoena documents, compel officer testimony, and name officers involved in investigations publicly. The Portland Police Association is publicly challenging these changes. Since the first work session in June, Hillsborough City Council and police have created a community outreach division to build trust and community engagement. They've also reformed training to include mandatory officer intervention when they witness excessive use of force, as well as a ban on chokeholds in all situations except those in which officers fear life safety. The city is also looking into alternatives for responses to people experiencing houselessness and those in mental distress, such as the Eugene-based CAHOOTS program. Members of the public are encouraged to email comments on police oversight. KBOO News poet Dan Raphael knows what he doesn't want for Christmas.
You better not cough. Is this distance enough? If you don't wear a mask, who'll take you to task? COVID Claus is coming to town. Most people catch it indoors. It spreads by air, not touch. Whether it's God's will or Earth's revenge, folks keep dying by the bunch. Over 100,000 Americans in hospitals because of COVID, and we're yet to see the results of Thanksgiving travels and feasts. After solstice, things will keep getting darker, not a sequence of surges, but one building on another building to overload. Can we hold our breath till there's enough vaccine for everybody? And you must trust the vaccine, produced for huge profit in a quarter of the usual time. Well, the first to get these risky shots will be healthcare workers. Who will nurse the nurses, doctor the doctors? Meet the new year, worse than the old year. Hope we haven't been fooled again. For Poetic Justice, this is Dan Raphael.
A new campaign is promoting sexual wellness for Native youth. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A text messaging campaign has rolled out that aims to promote sexual wellness for Indigenous youth across the Pacific Northwest. KLCC's Brian Bull reports.
Called Talking is Power, the goal is to get parents, guardians, and trusted community role models to sign up for texts that will provide resources for having important conversations with their kids and other youth. Topics include consent, protection, HIV and STDs, and intimate partner violence. Michelle Singers with the Northwest Portland Area Indian Health Board, one of the partners behind the text campaign.
The effect and the reach of text messages can reach far and wide, and that's why text messaging is so popular in a lot of our Native communities.
Singer says so far, nearly 200 parents have signed up for the weekly text messages. Federal data shows American Indians and Alaska Natives have a higher risk of sexually transmitted infections and HIV than other groups. For National Native News, I'm Brian Bull.
2020 was challenging in pushing Native voter turnout in North Dakota. Because of the pandemic, the state didn't see as much activity in tribal communities. North Dakota Native Vote says connections were still made. The group wanted to build on the higher turnout among Native populations the state saw in 2018. But early estimates indicate the number will be lower. Nicole Donaghy, executive director, says momentum's not lost.
We've made those connections and we were reinforcing our brand, getting, you know, North Dakota Native Vote out there again. And so people are certainly familiar with us, and that can only help.
Amid the election's final stages, COVID-19 cases were spiking in North Dakota. The group hosted virtual trainings, while the Sacred Pipe Resource Center deployed field staff for door-to-door canvassing when conditions allowed. For future elections, Executive Director Cheryl Carey says a goal is to raise more awareness about IDs.
You do have a very mobile population, so it's not uncommon for someone to have 2, 3, 4 addresses a year. And so trying to keep up and getting information out there that people, you know, where they can get their IDs and how they can update them and things like that.
The coalition would like to see more Native people work at polling places to help Indigenous voters. Tribal health programs and urban Indian health organizations will decide how to access the COVID-19 vaccine, according to the Indian Health Service. They have the option of receiving the vaccine from either the IHS or states. According to the IHS, once vaccines are available, they'll be allocated to IHS to distribute to tribal programs and urban centers. Federal health officials say tribal nations have been a key part of planning the vaccine rollout. The Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the IHS, and tribes are working on distribution for federal sites. The IHS provides services to more than 2 million American Indian and Alaska Native people across the country. As of late November, the IHS COVID-19 vaccine distribution list includes 337 places that will receive a COVID-19 vaccine from the agency when it becomes available. Television producers of ABC's Big Sky are addressing criticism from indigenous groups. The Associated Press reports the drama set in Montana follows the disappearance of two non-Native women. Indigenous groups, including Montana tribal leaders, sent a letter to producers in November saying the show overlooks the real issue impacting indigenous women. According to the Associated Press, the statement from producers said their eyes have been opened after conversations with the indigenous community, adding they're working to bring attention to the issue. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
Civil rights groups in Philadelphia have written a letter to the United Nations alleging misconduct by the Philly police against Black Lives Matter protesters. Andrea Sears has more on the story.
Civil rights groups have sent a written complaint to the United Nations over what they call violence and excessive force by Philadelphia police officers against Black Lives Matter protesters. The letter says police violence against demonstrators peacefully exercising their First Amendment rights in the demonstrations in May and June was a violation of international law. According to Mary Catherine Roper with the ACLU of Pennsylvania, the police violence and use of non-lethal weapons was not directed at people engaged in looting or vandalism.
The violence we recorded was aimed at people who were protesting, and in West Philadelphia, honestly, it was just aimed at the entire neighborhood.
In October, the Philadelphia City Council passed a law banning the use of tear gas, rubber bullets, and pepper spray against people engaged in First Amendment-protected activities. But Roper says none of the actions taken so far establish the accountability that's needed. She notes that UN special rapporteurs could issue a finding that use of excessive force by the Philadelphia police violated the protesters' human rights.
Requesting that the city take very specific steps to redress the harm that they have caused and to change their practices and their structures to make sure that this kind of thing can't happen again.
She adds that the UN also could confirm that the police violence was a violation of treaties and conventions that the United States is party to. Roper points out the use of violence against protesters in West Philadelphia in May and June took place less than a mile from where police firebombed the Move House in 1985.
No one has forgotten that, and it was a particularly terrorizing day because of that history of violence between the Philadelphia police and the Black community.
The letter to the UN contains a series of recommendations, including hiring an independent investigator to examine police violence against protesters. For Public News Service, I'm Andrea Sears.
You are listening to the KBOO Evening News for Wednesday, December 2nd, 2020. This is a volunteer-produced newscast, and we encourage your participation. Call or text us with your breaking news, stories, and tips at 971-245-2158. Our remote production team for tonight's newscast is Samantha Law, Brian Oster, Dan Raphael, and Jeffrey Wade. The producer is Nat Moon, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Antonia Gonzalez and Andrea Sears. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You are listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Althea Billings. All of our KBOO programs, including the Evening News, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or use our mobile app and click on Donate. Stay tuned.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician,
that's me, and a health literacy and communications expert,
that's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
Thank you.
COVID-19 and prisons. A study at the University of Texas Austin reveals that 231 people died from COVID-19 in the prison system. That number includes 27 prison staff members and 190 incarcerated persons. Now, of those incarcerated in prison who died of COVID-19, 9 were approved for parole and they were awaiting release. 21 had served 90% of their sentences and 58%, they were eligible for parole. And about 75% were not there to serve life sentences. And in county jails, 80% of deaths were people who had not been convicted of a crime and they were awaiting trial. These numbers highlight the severity of ongoing issues through the pandemic. Those who are incarcerated may not be receiving the benefits of prevention measures to limit the spread of COVID-19. Now, there are a lot of other situations, such as prison, where so many people are living in shared spaces and in close quarters and congregate type of living. Now, social distancing and mask wearing are possible, but it may be harder to limit the spread of the virus. And since there are so many shared surfaces and areas, Now, in other states, they've taken precautions to limit the transmission of the virus in the carceral system. For example, in New Jersey, they released thousands of incarcerated people in one day. Other states are making sure to provide those that are incarcerated with hand sanitizer, cleaning, and hygiene supplies, as well as masks. So, there may be some solutions to the issue. To start, 80% of people who died were over the age of 55. After the age of 55, most people's crime-prone years, and those are in big air quotes, crime-prone years are over, and they pose a low threat to public safety. So releasing these individuals from the carceral system will help reduce the risk. Now, we also need to make sure that people who are eligible for parole are released in a timely fashion. That could also help limit the risk within the carceral system.
COVID-19 sending racial minorities to hospitals at 4 times the rates of other groups. In all age groups, racial minorities have been disproportionately impacted by COVID-19. This disparity became more apparent once analysis of hospitalizations revealed that Black, Latinx, and Native Americans were each about 4 times more likely to be hospitalized from COVID-19 than white Americans or any other racial group.
Yeah, that includes health officials, and they've been aware and they've been warning about this trend for months. They believe that the way to address these disparities is to solve the upstream issues that cause them. Wouldn't that be nice? Some Black, Latinx, and Native American communities have lower rates of access to health care and coverage. I wonder why.
Right.
Let's see. The Black, Latinx, and Native American communities have lower rates. Anyway, those are the same groups that have higher rates of diseases that compound COVID-19 severity, like hypertension, heart disease, obesity, and diabetes. I wonder if there's a connection there.
Go figure. On top of those two factors, many work jobs where the risk of COVID-19 exposure is higher than in other fields of work. If they get sick, they may not have the means to miss work or to receive the care they need to get better. These issues can be dealt with in the short term by distributing PPE, or personal protective equipment, a COVID-19 vaccine, and cover for sick days to those at higher risk for worse outcomes from the virus.
Let me add another one. How about a $15 minimum wage? I would say at this point it should be $20.
Yeah, right.
But in the long term, we need to look at the reasons that lead to the existence of these disparities. I wonder what that is. The COVID-19 pandemic highlighted the inequities of our healthcare system. Particularly in a pandemic, people need to have easier access to the treatment and protective equipment. They need to be safe.
Yeah, evaluating and continuing to look at why some groups are more prone to have underlying conditions is one of the only way to solve these issues, but we can list a whole litany of others, right?
Oh, let's just start with...
Wait, we only got 10 minutes. We got one more stories.
Let's just start with what my lane is, which is the history of structural discrimination in society that has led to structural discrimination in medicine, which has led to these. And remember, folks, when we talk about the social determinants of health, all that refers to is those are the end streams of structural discrimination.
Well, that's it.
Vaccine myths debunked. As time draws closer and closer to a vaccine being approved, many people are elated and relieved that the coronavirus pandemic may be soon coming to an end. But
news of a vaccine also has led to a spread of rumors and false claims that could cause hesitation or an outright decline of vaccine demand. Now, the BBC News reports that social media has helped fuel these false claims about the vaccine. And one such false claim that was trending on Twitter was about Bill Gates. Now, one of the most shared claims this week is that the coronavirus pandemic is a cover for Gates' plan to implant tiny trackable microchips in people. Now, some TikTok users have even related some imaginary microchips to the mark of the beast. In fact, despite no evidence of that existing, do I even have to mention this? Yes, we do. But up to 28% of Americans believe this rumor to be true, with higher percentages in different populations. Now, false claims have also been spread by those who are seen to have an authority or inside knowledge. For example, a Newsmax TV correspondent, Emerald Robinson, told her 264,000 followers on Twitter to, quote unquote, beware of one of these vaccines. Her tweet suggested it tampers with your DNA. It does not. I'm telling you right now, it does not. There is no evidence to support this claim at all. I'm telling you, because this is an mRNA vaccine. It has nothing to do with DNA. But myths that the vaccine tampers with DNA have emerged on Facebook, YouTube, and other social mediums. Part of the misunderstanding seems to stem from the type of vaccines that's being developed. And again, this is a mRNA technology, or what's referred to as messenger RNA. It works by giving the body instructions to produce the spike protein. That's that protein that's on the surface of the coronavirus, right? That's what gives it its name, corona, the crown, right? It's that spike protein. It looks like a ball on the end of a stick, right? Now, the immune system ultimately learns to recognize that spike protein, and it produces antibodies against that protein. Now, mRNA, this is new technology, but that doesn't mean that people should shy away from it. New vaccines undergo rigorous safety checks before they can be recommended for widespread use. And one of the most widely spread false claims pertains to side effects. There can be side effects with any vaccine, but most are mild, they wear off quickly, and can be alleviated with over-the-counter pain relievers. Whenever there is something new, people do try to find information about it, but it can be hard to sometimes find accurate information, and when that happens, people will fill in the gaps with misinformation. This reduces confidence in vaccines. It's important to only listen to and share credible information from credible sources to prevent the spread of misinformation, and this is why we actually started the COVID Noise Filter podcast. And if you're listening to this podcast, thank you so much, because you care about credible information. COVID-19 versus measles. Now, measles deaths have risen to the highest levels in the past 23 years, according to a CDC report. Now, what makes this worse is the fact that the measles is vaccine preventable. Yes, this is a vaccine preventable illness. But COVID-19 has unfortunately disrupted those detection and immunization efforts, not only here in the US, but all over the world. And we're seeing that because in higher income countries, such as the US, there are record numbers of cases that are happening. Now, due to the pandemic, experts are worried about undercounting. Many of those at risk for measles do not have adequate access to healthcare, so no prevention efforts are available as well. On the provider side, resources are being used for COVID-19, but the Measles and Rubella Initiative sent a message that vaccinations need to remain despite loss of resources. Now, you see, something similar is happening in Ethiopia as well. Organizations, including the CDC, collaborated to set up a vaccination campaign just in June, and this included an increase in protective equipment and socially distant appointments. They were able to reach 14.5 million children. Overall, vaccination rates have become stagnant worldwide with COVID-19, and it's common in lower-income countries, but middle-income countries are seeing zero-dose children, and this decreases the result of growing skepticism around vaccinations and increased complacency, according to the UNICEF chief of immunization. Now, vulnerable populations in rural areas, urban underdeveloped areas, and places of violence hold a large proportion of these children. Now, to prevent a measles outbreak, 95% of the population needs to be vaccinated, and the world is currently stuck at 85% for the first injection and 71% for the second. According to the CDC report, progress toward elimination will require catch-up vaccination policies and engagement with the communities, especially under-resourced and low-income communities.
COVID Advisory Board, Dr. Marcella Nunez Smith. So this is going to be one of my favorites with respect to the appointees to the president-elect Joe Biden's COVID advisory panel. We have been profiling the appointees, and we're going to focus on Dr. Marcella Nunez Smith, who is one of my personal favorites. Now, Dr. Nunez Smith is originally from the U.S. Virgin Islands. She received her bachelor's degree from Swarthmore University before obtaining an MD from Jefferson Medical College, going to focus on internal medicine. Her residency training took place at Harvard University, and her fellowship was at Yale, where she received a master's degree in health sciences. Dr. Nunez Smith is now an associate professor of medicine and epidemiology at Yale University, where she conducts research focused on promoting health and healthcare equity for structurally marginalized populations. One of her current NIH-NCI-funded grants is to develop a tool to assess patient-reported experiences of discrimination in healthcare. Now, past projects include a study on the promotion and retention of diversity in medical school faculty and multiple articles on the experiences of minority students and faculty. She acts as the founding director of the Equity Research and Innovation Center. Dr. Marcella Nunez Smith's experience and expertise make her an excellent addition to this team, and we hope that her interest will help shape COVID-19 strategies that keep all voices in mind. We're so excited to have her on board, and I hope that you understand why she's one of my favorite appointees, because her academic record speaks for itself, especially when it comes to health equity. Just as a reminder, that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs?
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Dr. Dary and I have a daily show at 4 p.m. Central Standard Time, where we go into more detail on stories and answer your questions about COVID-19.
You can find Doc Griggs at DocGriggs1 on social media, and you can find me at Dr. Mark Allen Dary or at DRDERY. You can follow us at NoiseFilter on Instagram, NoiseFilterNola on Twitter, and for more information about us and the show, you can go to noisefiltershow.com. Hey, Doc Griggs, any last words?
Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving, and remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and